Hello and welcome to The Music and the Movies, a program that looks at and listens to the sweet spot where music and movies intersect. In this hour, we ponder the special alchemy that happens when sound meets image, where music lovers and cinephiles come together. We explore a different theme in each episode, arranged around an idea or a person, and we delve into why some of our favorite movie moments are also musical ones. My name is Robert Horton. I'm a movie critic and historian and a member of the National Society of Film Critics. I'll play some music and talk about it in an attempt to get to the bottom of a lifelong fascination with why film is so especially intoxicating when music is involved. And at the end of each show, I'll round things off with the trailer, a particular cut that either didn't fit into the overall flow or has some special meaning to me or just so weird it deserves its own spot. So join us, won't you, for The Music and the Movies. Today's episode, The Hollywood Blacklist. We're going to be considering an era that left a black mark on American movie history, The Blacklist, which is a kind of a shorthand term for a period during the early Cold War, although its roots are actually before that, when the fear of communist influence in American life resulted in accusations, betrayals, guilt by association, and a lot of people who lost their livelihoods for a long time, some forever. Lots of angles on this history. There were people who defied the hysteria and people who enabled it, card-carrying communists and fellow travelers and bystanders caught up in the witch hunt. We'll describe a few of these people and play some music associated with their films, some blacklisted composers, and also actors and filmmakers. Then for the trailer, at the end of the show, we're going to play a popular song that you will recognize, but maybe didn't know was popularized as the theme music for a film by soon-to-be blacklisted filmmakers. So the short version of Hollywood's Blacklist is that the House Committee on Un-American Activities, with the acronym HUAC, first appeared in the late 1930s and kind of quickly started snooping into Hollywood, the movie capital being, then as now, kind of a glamorous and headline-getting target for complaints about, you know, the decadence of society and all that. But then the United States and the Soviet Union found themselves on the same side in World War II, and the communist hunting was put on hold for the duration. But then after 1945, it started again, bursting into prominence with the interrogation and eventually incarceration of the Hollywood Ten, group of screenwriters and directors implicated in communist activity. They went to jail, actually, for contempt of Congress because they protested the very act of being interrogated, as they had not been formally charged with any crime. And it was not a crime to be a member of the Communist Party. The Hollywood Reporter published the names of suspected communists. So did a pamphlet called Red Channels. And suddenly, dozens of Hollywood professionals found themselves trying to prove their innocence or dodging questions or cutting deals. We're going to get into some of those nuances. But first, we're going to talk about an example of how the blacklist cut short promising careers. We'll start with a 1947 film called Force of Evil, a slashing, surprisingly cynical crime drama in which John Garfield, then a major star, plays a daringly unsympathetic protagonist. Ambitious, greedy, man determined to bag the American dream, even if he crushes the people around him. The movie, one of Martin Scorsese's faves, by the way, was the directing debut of the screenwriter Abraham Polonsky. It was also the last film he would direct for 20 years. He was about to be blacklisted. For that matter, John Garfield, though no communist, had been implicated. His wife was a party member, for one thing. He was called before HUAC in 1951, and he said, "I have nothing to hide and nothing to be ashamed of. My life is an open book. I am no red. I am a Democrat by politics, a liberal by inclination, and a loyal citizen of this country by every act of my life." His movie career froze up anyway, and some months later, he apparently was going to plan some kind of PR campaign where he could emerge as an anti-communist but not have to name names. His marriage was on the rocks then, but he was confronted by the FBI, who had the evidence about his wife being a party member, and would clear him if he would publicly denounce her. He got up and walked out of the room, leaving an expletive in his wake. And 10 days later, he died of a heart attack. He was 39. Here's music from the opening credits of Force of Evil, composed by David Raxon. Music from the film Force of Evil, composed by David Raxon. That film directed by and starring two blacklisted people, Abraham Polonsky and John Garfield. Speaking of David Raxon, his name brings up another category of people in the blacklist. One of the most odious things about being called before Congress to explain or admit one's own involvement in communism, or even just left-leaning activities, was the expectation that it wasn't enough to talk about yourself. You were expected to name names, to give up other people involved in that world, and thus to betray co-workers, friends, sometimes even family members. People like the Hollywood 10 refused to name names, most of them anyway. One member of that group later cooperated with HUAC and got his career back. So David Raxon is one composer who did cooperate after admitting his own brief membership in the Communist Party some years before. He later felt guilty about this. Like some others that cooperated, Raxon only named people who had been already known by the committee. The point of demanding the names had to do with humiliation and obedience, frankly, not actual fact-finding. And so he got his career back, and others did not. Here is Raxon's most famous movie music, the theme to the 1944 mystery Laura. famous musical theme from Laura, composed by David Raxon. He's an example of a friendly witness before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. Raxon got his career back after naming names. But one of the strange elements about HUAC was that even if you cooperated, you might not be allowed to come back. One of the saddest tales of this era is about Larry Parks, a name you might not have heard, and there's a good reason for that. Parks had worked his way up as an actor, doing small roles, until he was cast as the legendary vaudeville performer Al Jolson in The Jolson Story, which was the number one hit of 1946. He got an Oscar nomination for his performance, and he had finally made it. He'd hit the big time. He followed up with another hit sequel a couple of years later. And then in 1951, Parks was called before the House Committee, and he tried something unusual. He admitted that he'd been a member of the Communist Party a decade earlier. He said he had been a concerned young man who felt that the party offered some possible solutions for issues of equality in the world. And then he'd quit after 5 years or so. But it wasn't enough to be honest about that. The committee wanted names of other people. And here, Parks grappled with the agony of being asked to rat on his friends. He said to the committee, "I feel that to be asked to name names like this is not in the way of American justice as we know it. I think my career has been ruined by this, and I would appreciate not having the choice of either being in contempt of this committee and going to jail, or forcing me to really crawl through the mud to be an informer. For what purpose?" The upshot was that Parks did name names in kind of a backroom testimony. It wasn't supposed to be publicized, except it was. And mostly he named people who had already been named by others. This was trying to save his career, and he got nothing out of it. His career died. He had the humiliation of having betrayed his friends, and no credit for plainly owning up to his own former life as a communist. He made three other movies scattered throughout the rest of his life. He developed a song and dance show on stage with his wife, Betty Garrett, delightful comedian who grew up partly in Seattle and Tacoma, actually, and she was also blacklisted. But Parks never got his stardom back. He died at the age of 60. From their era as song and dance entertainers while blacklisted, here's a bit of Larry Parks and Betty Garrett doing the classic song Side by Side, which sounds poignant here when you consider they were exiled together from the movies.
No matter what the weather,
just as long as we're together,
nothing seems to matter at all. Oh, we ain't got a barrel of money. Maybe we're ragged and funny, but we'll travel along singing a song side by side. Don't know what's coming tomorrow. Maybe it's trouble and sorrow, but we'll travel the road sharing our load side by side.
Through all kinds of weather, what if that sky should fall?
Just as long as we're together, it doesn't matter at all.
When they've all had their quarrels and parted, we'll be the same as we started, traveling along, singing a song, side by side. Shall we dance?
Delighted.
Oh, they ain't got a barrel of money. Maybe they're ragged and funny,
but we'll travel along, singing a song, side by side.
Don't know what's coming tomorrow. Maybe it's trouble and sorrow,
but we'll travel the road, sharing our load, side by side.
Through all kinds of weather, what if the sky should fall? Just as long as we're together,
it doesn't seem to matter at all. When they've all had their quarrels and parted, we'll be the same as we started, traveling along, singing a song, side by side.
traveling along, singing a song. Sigh,
Side by Side, composed by Harry Woods, sung by two blacklisted actors, Larry Parks and Betty Garrett. After the blacklist, Betty Garrett would become a familiar face on TV again in the 60s and 70s on sitcoms and game shows, but the blacklist ended it for Larry Parks. You're listening to The Music and the Movies. I'm Robert Horton. We are talking about the era of the Hollywood blacklist. Maybe the most famous cooperative witness during this era was the director Elia Kazan, whose celebrated career had already made him a kingpin of Broadway and Hollywood. Kazan testified to the committee in 1951 and declined to name names. He was willing to discuss his own brief membership in the Communist Party when he was in New York theater in the 1930s. He called that experience a degradation ceremony in which the acts of informing were more important than the information conveyed. Nevertheless, when with his film A Streetcar Named Desire, nominated for a bunch of Oscars, and his career in the balance, he went before the committee as a friendly witness in 1952, meaning that he named names. He also ran a full-page ad in the New York Times saying why he did it and denouncing communism. So his career continued very successfully, although many of his old friends cut off communication with him. In 1954, he directed and won an Oscar for On the Waterfront, story of corruption in the New York Longshoremen Union, with dock worker Marlon Brando heroically deciding to inform on and give testimony against the gangsters who have taken over the union. That movie, written by Bud Schulberg, another friendly witness, takes pains to show the difficulty of informing, but also presents it as a moral imperative in this case. We'll talk about Kazan's interest in the subject in a minute. First, here's a little of the great score of On the Waterfront, composed by Leonard Bernstein. This is from one of the film's most famous scenes, with Brando and Rod Steiger in the back of a taxi, which segues into a livelier section.
Thank you.
music composed by Leonard Bernstein for On the Waterfront. Bernstein himself would come under surveillance by the FBI and be quietly blackballed from TV for a little while, although he was not called before HUAC to testify. As for On the Waterfront, you recall that it climaxes with Brando's character informing and finally triumphing. In his autobiography, Elia Kazan, and it's an amazing book, by the way, wrote, "That was me saying with identical heat that I was glad I'd testified as I had. On the Waterfront was my own story. Every day I worked on that film, I was telling the world where I stood and my critics to go F themselves." He didn't say F, but he spelled it out. Now, On the Waterfront, you know, you can see and enjoy that movie without any knowledge of The Blacklist. It is a universal story of courage. But Kazan put into it what he wanted that created some of its force. The director Jules Dassin, who reshaped himself as a European director after he was blacklisted, said, "You look for forgiveness, you try to understand, but I can't manage it with Kazan. Their betrayal is a continuing pain because these are guys I loved. Lee Cobb was one of my oldest friends. I loved Kazan. What he did was diabolical." In 1999, the Academy gave Kazan an honorary Oscar, which even at that distance caused controversy. And when he walked on stage, some people applauded and others remained in their seats, their arms crossed in protest. Mentioning Jules Dassin reminds us that some blacklisted filmmakers went abroad to ply their trade, sometimes under a pseudonym at first. Dassin successfully became a European director, and there's a piece of music associated with one of his biggest hits that we can include here. A starring vehicle for his wife, the Greek actress Melina Mercouri, Never on Sunday became an international hit in 1960, won an Oscar for its theme song by Manos Hadjidakis. Let's listen to that familiar tune, Never on Sunday.
Ένα, δύο και τρία και τέσσερα φίλια που φτάνουν στο λιμάνι. Ένα και δύο και τρία και τέσσερα πουλιά. Πώς ήθελα να έχω ένα και δύο και τρία και τέσσερα παιδιά. Πόσα θα μεγαλώσουν όλα να γίνουν λεβένες για χάρη του Πύρια. Κι αν ψάξω δεν βρίσκω άλλο λιμάνι. Τρελή να με έχει κάνει όσο το Πειραιά. Όταν βραδιάζει τραγούδια μαραδιάζει και τις παινιές του αλλάζει. Γέμιζε από παιδιά. Από την πόρτα μου σαγώ δεν υπάρχει κανείς που να μην τον αγαπώ. Και σαν το βράδυ κοιμηθώ, ξέρω πως, ξέρω πως θα τον ονειρεύτω. Πετρά διαβάζω στο λαιμό και μια χά και μια χάντρα φυλαχτώ. Γιατί τα βράδια καρτερώ στο λιμάνι σ' αυγό κάποιον άγνωστο να βρω. Όσο κι αν ψάξω δεν βρίσκω άλλο λιμάνι. Τρέλη να με έχει κάνει όσο το Πειραιά. Που όταν βραδιάζει τραγούδια μαραδιάζει και τις παινιές του αλλάζει. Γέμιζε από παιδιά.
The Oscar-winning theme from Never on Sunday, composed by Manos Hadzidakis and sung by Melina Mercury. A film directed by a blacklisted director in exile, Jules Dassin. Well, let's listen to music by a few composers who were blacklisted. We're going to begin with Saul Kaplan, who worked on the soundtracks of a few dozen films before running into the blacklist in 1953. That year, he did a moody noir score for Niagara, starring Marilyn Monroe, which sounds like this. Music from Niagara, composed by Saul Kaplan, just before he was blacklisted in 1953. You're listening to The Music and the Movies. I'm Robert Horton, and we're talking about the Hollywood blacklist today. When Kaplan came back to work after the blacklist lifted, he sometimes worked with blacklisted directors, for instance, Martin Ritt on The Spy Who Came in from the Cold. He also did the music for blacklisted writer-director Carl Foreman's World War II drama The Victors in 1963, a very cynical movie that cuts right against the usual triumphalism of most war films. Here is a cut titled The French Woman, from that score, a title that refers to a character played by the great Jean Moreau, and an interlude from the fighting. Music from The Victors, composed by Saul Kaplan, who would go on to work pretty steadily, including a couple of episodes of the original Star Trek series. The Victors, by the way, is notable for a haunting musical cue, but not one of Kaplan's. There's one sequence that recreates in fictional form the incident of the only U.S. soldier executed for desertion during World War II, Private Eddie Slovic, which is played on a vast field of snow to the tune of Frank Sinatra singing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. It is an amazingly bitter sequence. In many ways, the film was ahead of its time, kind of anticipating other anti-war movies like MASH and Catch-22. The writer-director of that film, Carl Foreman, had been blacklisted, and in fact, he wrote the classic Western High Noon just as he was about to be questioned, turning that story into an allegory for the blacklist hysteria, with fear getting the upper hand in a community. Another blacklisted composer was George Bassman, who had been knocked around a while in a variety of ways over the years. He composed the standard I'm Getting Sentimental Over You. He arranged and composed for movies, radio, and stage. His work included some Marx Brothers movies and orchestrations for The Wizard of Oz. Let's listen to a cue from a movie he scored after he came off the blacklist, 1962 Western, directed by Sam Peckinpah, Ride the High Country. Getting here some of the melancholy and weariness of the two veteran gunmen played by Joel McRae and Randolph Scott. Music from Ride the High Country, composed by George Bassman. Well, speaking of Westerns and Sam Peckinpah, we are going to talk about a composer who worked on a handful of Peckinpah's films. Jerry Fielding came up as a jazz musician and big band player and a music director for radio. He was never a communist, but I guess you could say he was a Marxist because he got a gig doing the music directing for Groucho Marx on radio and TV. In fact, when Fielding talked about being hauled before the Congressional Committee, he intimated that they really wanted him to name Groucho as a possible sympathizer. But Fielding took the Fifth Amendment and refused to testify, which cost him his career for a while, although he toured with his jazz band and put out some records. He told one interviewer, "I ran afoul of the Hollywood blacklist at that period because I've always been a very loudmouth crusader on very many issues. I always will be. I got hit very hard and I was kind of run out of town for 10 years." Then in 1962, the director Otto Preminger, who had helped break the blacklist a couple of years earlier by finally giving the exiled screenwriter Dalton Trumbo an on-screen credit for his film Exodus, decided to hire Jerry Fielding to compose a score for Advise and Consent, big canvas look at Washington, D.C. politicking. Fielding came up with music both traditional and very inventive, but you'll hear him stretching his more experimental muscles with this track, which is titled Politely Political. Thank you. Whistling along there with music from Advise and Consent, the movie that brought the blacklisted composer Jerry Fielding back to work for the big screen. Fielding's work for Sam Peckinpah's astonishing 1969 Western, The Wild Bunch, remains a remarkable, I think still edgy, score with its unusual rhythms and mournful but sometimes violent sound. So here's Jerry Fielding's truly grabby opening track with its crisp drumming and drifting melodies, creating a dislocating soundscape.
Thank you.
Music from The Wild Bunch, composed by Jerry Fielding. And if that is one of the most amazing opening sequences of any movie, and it is, Fielding's music certainly has a lot to do with that. You're listening to The Music in the Movies. I'm Robert Horton, and we're talking about the Blacklist era in Hollywood. We'll hear one more cut from the formerly blacklisted Fielding here from one of his films with Clint Eastwood, a true jazz aficionado. It's a cue from The Gauntlet, which Eastwood starred in and directed in 1977. He plays a cop assigned to bring a prostitute from Las Vegas to Phoenix so she can testify in a mob trial, which of course means the mafia is trying to destroy them for the entirety of the journey. Kind of a preposterous situation, and yet actually a pretty solid movie. Fielding does a jazz score that suits the 70s setting. This cue is called Black Sedan. Music from The Gauntlet, composed by the once blacklisted Jerry Fielding. Next, we're going to return to a blacklisted actor for a nod to Lionel Stander, one of the great character actors of Hollywood history, who lost a big part of his career to the blacklist. He wasn't a communist, but he'd supported a lot of causes in his time, and somebody had named him before the House committee. He actually petitioned to testify so he could clear his name, but he had no intention of naming names or cooperating in this constitutionally questionable hearing. Instead of answering their questions, he launched into his own statement before the committee, and I quote, "I know of some subversion, and I can help the committee if it's really interested. I know of a group of fanatics who are desperately trying to undermine the Constitution of the United States by depriving artists and others of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness without due process of law. If you're interested in that, I would like to tell you about it. I can tell names, I can cite instances, and I am one of the first victims of it. These people are engaged in the conspiracy outside of all the legal processes to undermine our very fundamental American concepts upon which our entire system of jurisprudence exists, etc." By that point, of course, the committee members were banging their gavels and interrupting and realizing he was not talking about a communist conspiracy. He was talking about them. Apparently, Sanders' testimony drew laughter in the room at the time, and it reads today like a defiant stand, but he was blacklisted for years. But he got to come back, including a long Emmy-winning run on the TV show Heart to Heart. This gives me an excuse to play music I've been wanting to play for a while, because Stander had a role in Steven Spielberg's legendary box office disaster, 1941, a comedy about Californians panicked about a possible Japanese attack. The march from that film is by John Williams, and it's maybe my favorite movie theme by that composer. March from 1941, composed by John Williams, offered here in tribute to a blacklisted actor in that film, Lionel Stander. Well, there's our trailer music, and we have a pop standard here, which was used in a 1948 film written and directed by about-to-be blacklisted filmmakers, the screenwriters Ben Bartzman and Alfred Lewis Levitt, and the director Joseph Losey. The movie is The Boy with Green Hair, a real progressive fable about prejudice and tolerance, in which little Dean Stockwell wakes up one day with green hair and is ostracized because of his difference. The theme song over the opening credits was Nature Boy, a famous, somewhat mystical song by Eden Abez, first recorded that same year by Nat King Cole. Here is the movie version, rendered by a Hollywood chorus. The song Nature Boy, written by Eden Abez, a singular tune that fits the movie The Boy with Green Hair, which was directed by Joseph Losey just before he was blacklisted out of Hollywood. Losey recreated his career in Europe, but he said of the blacklist era, "I had physical attacks. I thought I was going to die. I went to various doctors and it was sheer absolute panic because I had nothing. I was 44, so I was at the point where most people begin to coast in their lives and everything that I had accomplished meant nothing." We're going to leave our discussion of The Blacklist there. We will go out with a track that is one of the most famous of all American songs, and it was written by a blacklistee, Yip Harburg, who wasn't a communist but knew his way around a few radical organizations, was the lyricist for classics such as Brother Can You Spare a Dime and the great songs from the musical Finian's Rainbow. And speaking of rainbows, here's that song, music by Harold Arlen, words by Yip Harburg, written for The Wizard of Oz and rendered with soulfulness by Judy Garland, in a way that suits our melancholy subject today. I'm Robert Horton. I thank you for listening to the music and the movies.
Far behind me. melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops. That's where you'll find me. Somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly. Birds fly over the rainbow. Why then, oh why can't I? If happy little bluebirds fly beyond the rainbow.